KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
In Seattle.
The cars that were in demand the most are probably the cars that you can't get your hands on. And one of the reasons is that cars are just better quality than they used to be.
Let's get going. Start the car, Rochester.
Yes, sir.
I always encourage people to experiment. If they can't find it in the restaurants here in Seattle or it's far away, you know, get a great cookbook and try making it at home.
That's food writer Sarah Dickerman. She's going to join us later this hour to get a lunch and cookbook recommendation. She's here every Thursday. Jack Benny in Rochester demonstrated for us the importance of sound effects in radio. Katie Sewell will be in regular Thursday radio retrospective. And a little bit later this hour, we're going to talk about the value of used cars, whether you should buy a used car, new car, anything like that. It's ahead on 94.9 KUOW. Good morning. I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher. Before we talk cars, we're going to talk about pensions. This week, lawmakers in Olympia heard about a proposal that would overhaul the state retirement plans for public employees. Senate Bill 5856 would end pensions for new state workers who are under 45, and it would shift them to employee investment plans. The sponsor, Senator Rodney Tom, says it would reduce the state's financial liability and put the public sector in line with the shift toward 401ks. That shift is taking place in the private sector. Here's the Senate Majority Caucus Leader, Tom, speaking at a hearing on the proposal Monday.
I think what we're doing with our current pension system is basically passing down those obligations to our children who already have an extreme debt and obligations that are going to be placed on them from our mess at the federal level. And we need to do everything that we can at the state level to give our kids a chance. And whatever the bill might be, we need to put it in our generation. And I think we're only going to be able to do that by moving forward in a defined contribution system.
Senator Tom also says pensions are rare and they can be a source of friction between people who have them and people who do not.
Only about 7% of funds out there are defined benefit plans. And when you have that much disparity between what our taxpayers can have and what our employees have, it creates a little tension with our citizens who are actually footing the bill.
Finally, Tom says we need to move in a direction that gives workers more flexibility with their retirement funds.
There is not a set retirement age. There's people that might want to retire at 60. There's people that might want to retire at 65. There's people that might want to retire at 70 and beyond. And moving to a more of a 401 type program gives that flexibility. It also gives the public the assurance that, you know, we're all in this together.
That's Senator Rodney Tom speaking about a plan to overhaul pensions, the pension plan for state workers. SPIA is the engineering union for Boeing. The 7,500 technical workers are going to vote again on Boeing's latest contract offer. This still includes a proposal that would give new hires a 401k plan instead of the Boeing pension. The engineers union announced that yesterday after a day of bargaining. That announcement comes after union president Tom McCarty was quoted saying the union had decided to drop its demand that a labor contract include a pension plan for new workers. SPIA denied the report on Tuesday, saying it was only McCarty's opinion that the pension issue was dead. But the union says accepting the company's latest offer would lock in what it calls considerable improvements achieved since the company's initial offer. SPIA said its negotiating committee would make no voting recommendation to its members. Negotiators will meet again on Friday. So as you hear, pension reform is a big issue. The plans that are working their way through the state Senate and a similar measure working its way through the state House are not without a lot of controversy. And joining us this hour to talk more about pension reform in general and these proposals in specific are Paul Guppy, a vice president for research at the Washington Policy Center, and Jeff Johnson, president of the Washington State Labor Council. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Marcy.
Paul Guppy, I want to start with you. Perhaps you can explain a little bit more clearly, not this proposal specifically, but the difference between a defined benefit system like what we have now and a defined contribution system, which is, I believe, the general term for what Senator Tom is proposing.
Sure. The difference is actually that only in government are there traditional defined benefit pensions, which means that the employer, in this case the taxpayers, are making a commitment to pay a certain amount of money to every retired state employee every month indefinitely into the future after they retire. And so it really puts taxpayers on the hook. That's what Senator Tom was referring to about the financial burden. You hear about unfunded liability, and that's where that problem comes from. The rest of the world, quite some time ago, went to defined contribution plans where the employee owns the retirement savings themselves in a 401k or an IRA type plan, and the employer during their working time makes contributions to that. The employee can make contributions. Those are tax free, and the employee builds up a nest egg that they then own at retirement. What's encouraging about Senator Tom's plan is he's showing that Democrats and Republicans can come together to modernize the state plan for younger workers while maintaining the current benefit for workers who are over 45.
I should give a caveat right off the bat that I am a state worker and I am part of the state retirement system. Right now, I make a contribution and the state matches that contribution. Would the state give any portion of money to a retirement plan as it does now?
Yes, so that's standard. So all defined contribution plans, virtually all of them, include a matching contribution from the employer along with whatever is put in by the employee. The primary difference is that that money goes into a personal account that's owned by the employee and can never be taken away. So no matter what happens with the employer in the future, in the case of the state, if they have a financial crisis, there's a funding shortfall, the employee knows that when retirement comes, they own their own financial benefit and they control it themselves, and it will be there when they decide to retire.
Isn't it more subject to the volatility of the market, though?
That depends on how the employee wants to manage the funds. And so there are financial advisors who will usually tell younger workers that they can invest in the stock market. There's a chance of greater return. But, of course, as everyone gets to be 50 or 55, and again, this is standard in the private sector, the retirement savings are put into safer investments, either mutual funds or government bonds, that are not as risky. And therefore, you don't run the risk of losing your retirement when you get into your 60s.
So, Paul Guppy, I infer that you are in support of this pension reform measure.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea, especially for younger state workers who can make the choice. And this proposal is being made for new hires and for existing workers who are under 45. There would be no change for state workers who are over 45. But the other benefit, as I mentioned, is that it takes taxpayers off the hook. 20 years from now, if the plan gets into a crisis, it doesn't automatically lead to tax increases because every state employee would own their own retirement.
Jeff Johnson from the Washington State Labor Council, you are not a supporter of this plan.
No, Marcy, I'm not. Current defined benefit plans, including the one you have, provides a guaranteed retirement income for public employees based on their final average salary and for each year of service that they performed for public service. And you're right, the state equally matches that contribution, 100%. Under Senator Tom's bill, the state's contribution drops to 80% of every dollar that a worker puts in. But more importantly, and you hit it, a 401k plan, the value of that portfolio is totally dependent on market fluctuations out there. And anyone who had a 401k plan over the last 5 years through this Great Recession, I don't care how smart an investment advisor they might have had, the value of their portfolio dropped anywhere from 30 to 60%. And if you're near retirement age and your portfolio drops that much and you're depending on that money, that income to survive, you're in a world of hurt versus a defined benefit plan where you have a guaranteed monthly income And Marcy, you're right. It's not just taxpayers that pay for that. Workers put for every dollar the state puts in, public employees put a dollar in. Moreover, they take lower wages than private sector workers in exchange for those pension contributions. And finally, public employees pay taxes too. So they're also contributing to their pensions through the taxes they pay.
We're talking about pension reform this hour on Weekday. Jeff Johnson is president of Washington State Labor Council. Jeff, as Paul Guppy points out, at one point the fixed benefits plans were common. Now in the private sector, they are not. So if, for example, the state agreed to match dollar for dollar into a 401k, what would be the argument with that?
Okay, so a couple of things. One, Mr. Guppy repeats the same factual mistake that Senator Tom does. Defined pension plans of those with retirement income in our country range between 20 and 25% have defined benefit plans, including the private sector. I work in the private sector. I have a defined benefit plan. In fact, I have two of them. But the problem with 401k systems, even if the state matched you dollar for dollar, one, it doesn't take away from the market volatility argument. And like I said, if you've lived through this great recession and you have a 401k, you know how hard it hurt. It's put many seniors into poverty. But moreover, a recent study just came out showing that the average 401k holder in our country right now at retirement age has a portfolio worth $120,000, which comes out to about $7,000 a year annuity, not hardly enough to live on, right? The other thing is that we know that one-third of people who have 401ks, particularly those under the age of 45, borrow against that 401k. So basically, they are borrowing their future retirement income to make expenses, to just maintain their standard of living or to pay bills, ordinary expenses. So 401ks are a route towards disaster for employees.
Now, Paul Guppy, I know you don't agree with that assessment from Jeff Johnson, but I want to talk a little bit about the competing proposals in the legislature. We talked about Senator Tom's, but in fact, there's a similar measure in the House of Representatives that is has a little bit different requirements for people under 45. And one of the things that struck me about both proposals is the mandated contribution. It sounds like workers wouldn't necessarily be able to pull money out of those funds. Or am I reading that incorrectly?
Well, as I understand it, the agreement on being hired is that the state worker would contribute to their own retirement some amount, the same way that all Americans contribute to the Social Security system. In the case of a 401k type plan, is that the worker is contributing during their working life to their own account. So they are building up their own retirement savings, and then those are matched by whatever agency or government that they work for. These plans do work. They're not as risky as was described, because as a worker approaches retirement, you begin putting the funds into treasury bonds and assets that do not go up and down with the stock market, so you begin to take the risk out of it. Also, I wouldn't say that a state pension is guaranteed, because it depends entirely on politics. The legislature can change the state pension fund anytime that they like. They can change the contributions. And, of course, if we get into a financial crisis in the future and there's just no money, then it'll be a situation in which the state won't be able to follow through with all the promises that they've made. Government changes the deal all the time when it comes to pension plans.
I'm going to now speak with my state worker hat on, because it's very hard for me to divorce myself from the fact that I am part of this pension plan. But one thing that Jeff Johnson pointed out is that, unlike the private sector, state workers have had a pay freeze for many years now. It doesn't look like that pay cap is going to be lifted anytime soon. And so one of the arguments for going into public service has been that there are benefits that make up for the fact that most of us earn below market wage.
Sure, that's a good point. And when the state is hiring high-quality workers, it's the entire compensation package, the salary plus the health care plus retirement benefits, and that's what employees need to look at. The thing is that with a pension plan like this is that it's the taxpayers in the private sector that have to fund it. So in a lot of cases, taxpayers are paying to fund pensions for state workers when they don't have pensions themselves. So I think there's a fairness issue here in thinking about what the public is being asked to bear and while allowing the state to recruit good workers. As I understand it, there's no shortage of people who want to work for state government. They're good jobs with good benefits, certainly compared to what's common in the private sector.
Well, maybe pensions should be mandated for all workers. Wouldn't that solve the disparity?
Well, that was common in the 1950s, and the reason that we shifted to a more modern system with defined contribution plans is because it allows workers to own their own retirement. More than half of Americans are now invested in the stock market because they own their own savings. They're not dependent on the Acme Corporation or whoever it is that they work for. Their savings and their retirement and their financial assets are independent of their employer. And that's what the public sector is starting to move towards, too.
Jeff Johnson, one of the things that I've seen in looking at editorializing in newspapers across the state and looking at various public opinion polls, it seems like non-public sector workers really believe that public employees are overly compensated, and they'd like to see more parity between systems. And I'm just wondering about your opinion. How can public employees buck the greater public opinion on this issue and others?
You know, part of it would be the media laying the facts out more clearly, and because we know that from salary surveys done every year in this state that public employees are paid between 10% and 20% lower wages in similar occupations to the private sector, so they are not overly compensated. It's why having a pension plan and a health care make state employment more attractive. So as you detract from the pension system, make state employment less attractive to workers out there. And I do want to say this. I need to raise this issue. Two things. One, we have the lowest cost and best funded defined benefit pension plan in the country right now. You know, our state investment board continually wins awards over their management of these funds. There is no crisis in our pension fund. The other thing I wanted to say is in retirement income theory, it's based on a three-legged stool. Social Security is one leg, individual savings is a second leg, and the third leg is supposed to be a pension, right? On that second leg of the stool, individual savings, people own their own accounts. They can, participate in 401k systems, so on and so forth. But the pension portion of it, what you want to do as a society is have a guaranteed income in retirement. So there's real retirement security, not insecurity as there is in 401ks. And, I think I do pretty well at investing my 401k, but I'd stand it up to Mr. Guppy's any day of the week, but I bet you that he lost just as I did and the average American did, anywhere from 30 to 50% of the value of their 401k over the last 4 years. It's only been over the last two, as the stock market has risen, that those values have come back. But I didn't need that income then. Those at retirement age, they needed it, and they lost.
At least one labor leader, not yourself, has said that even if these bills pass through Olympia, they're going to be subject to a legal challenge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there are equal protections here because it mandates current employees 45 years of age or younger to move into this 401k plan. When they signed on to state employment, they signed on to a pension plan with specific contribution limits. And I think the Bakken House decision gives them the right to sue and more likely than not defeat this in court.
Paul Guppy, if these measures pass and if they survive a legal challenge, realistically, when would we see a change in pension at the state worker level?
Well, I think it would happen very slowly because no worker who was within 20 years of retirement would be affected. So, and also, it's not the case that someone who is in their 60s is not investing their 401k in risky stocks that go up and down. Those assets are moved into investments that are more safe, like treasury bills, which don't go down in value. But regarding state workers, if a transition plan went into place, and Jeff makes a good point about the legal challenge, because for existing workers have contractual rights to the pension they have. So Barbara Bailey has a proposal to make it, she's a senator, Republican senator. She has a proposal that would make it voluntary for younger workers who are currently working for the state, and then new hires would join the new system. So making it voluntary, I think, is a good idea. But so in answer to your question, the transition would happen very slowly. And what it would do for taxpayers in particular is reduce the billions of unfunded liability that stretches out into the future. So as younger workers transition to a more modern retirement plan, it eases the burden that's placed on the existing pension system decades into the future, so that workers who are 45 and older will actually be in a stronger system financially because there will be less liability.
Paul Guppy is Vice President for Research at the Washington Policy Center. Jeff Johnson, President of the Washington Labor Council. Bills that would significantly reform the state pension system are making their way through Olympia. This is KUOW.
It's a particularly good time to sell a used car. We'll find out why in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from North Seattle Community College, committed to improving lives through education, with short-term certificates, associate and transfer degrees, and career training, including international business, engineering, and more. Enrolling now for spring quarter. Information at northseattle.edu.
-46 degrees and rainy in Seattle. Expect rain through the day with an afternoon high of 50. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1026. We're going to find out about the folks who made those old-time radio sound effects in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. If you've been shopping, you know that right now is a terrible time to buy a used car. But it's an excellent time to sell your used car, especially here in Seattle. Between 2008 and 2010, sales of new cars plunged, and that has caused a shortage of used cars. According to Forbes magazine, Seattle's the second worst city in the country to buy one of those cars. Why here? We get some answers this morning from Micheline Maynard. She covers business and the automobile industry for Forbes.com, among other publications. And when we spoke yesterday, I asked her why used cars are so much in demand right now.
One of the biggest reasons that used cars are so much in demand is that the market fell apart about 4 years ago. So if you think about it, people who lease cars generally lease them for 3 or 4 years. So they would be turning their cars back in right around now. Well, the market in 2009 and 2010 was just awful. The market fell about 40% from 2007 to 2009 because of the recession. So we've got the tightest used car market in probably a dozen years. And that is really the big reason.
How did the government stimulus to sort of get rid of your gas guzzler and buy a new energy-efficient car contribute to this, or didn't it?
It contributed a little bit. If you think back to the Cash for Clunkers program, what that did was get rid of clunkers, essentially. It encouraged people to go in with their old cars, and if they could get something that was demonstrably better fuel economy, then they could get a federal subsidy. Well, that pulled an awful lot of used cars out of the market, and the rules of the program was that they had to be trashed. They couldn't be resold. So you lost used cars in that way, but you also lose used cars just because people weren't buying as many new cars, so there aren't cars to sell.
Well, that's incredible. Are there certain kinds of cars that are really looking at a premium? For instance, I have a Subaru. It's a 2001. I get letters all the time from Subaru dealerships.
Well, you live in the part of the country where Subaru is particularly popular. Subaru is also big on the East Coast and here in the upper Midwest where we deal with snow. In fact, we had a big snowstorm overnight, and I have a hybrid, but I have snow tires. I was really glad to have that extra bit of traction. So essentially, if you just look at the cars that were in demand the most are probably the cars that you can't get your hands on. And one of the reasons is that cars are just better quality than they used to be. So a three-year-old K Camry, Toyota Camry, for example, that's a baby. It's, you know, it's going to go for another 6 or 8 or 10 more years. So there's no reason for its owner to sell it. And unfortunately, you're just not going to get a good deal on one of those recent used cars.
I know that the Detroit automakers have made a rebound in the market. They're doing a little bit better vis-a-vis some of their Japanese competitors. But is in your part of the world, are Detroit-made cars, or at least American-made cars, of as high value as the Toyotas, the Hondas, the Subarus?
One of the things to look at when you go out to buy a used car are the Consumer Reports guidelines that govern cars that are 3 years old or older. And if you think about the quality improvements that Detroit automobiles have made, they've made those quality improvements in pretty much the first year of ownership out to the third year of ownership. But after the third year of ownership, that's when the problems start to pop up, whereas with Japanese models, Korean models, you don't really see that as much. And so a three-year-old Toyota might be worth more than a three-year-old General Motors product. It depends on the car, and it depends on the vehicle specifically. But generally, what Consumer Reports has found is that Detroit's catching up a bit on quality, but not on long-term quality.
That's interesting. It sounds like a problem that they're going to have to solve if they want to continue.
It's a problem that they've faced for years, and I wrote my book, The End of Detroit, in 2003. It's 10 years old this year, and 10 years ago people were talking about this problem, and it still exists.
It's amazing. According to Forbes magazine, Seattle is second after Jackson, Mississippi, in having the most expensive used car market. I wonder what accounts for the variations from place to place, because it didn't really seem so much about West Coast, East Coast.
No. And I think in the case of Jackson, Mississippi, it's just that there aren't a lot of cars in Jackson.
That could be. So, I'm not familiar with Jackson.
Yeah, I've been to Jackson a few times, and it's a nice town, but it's not a very big city. But let me raise this issue about Seattle, because one of the things that I've been doing lately is research on where people are walking and taking public transportation. And Seattle ranks as one of the top five walkable, bikeable cities in the country. So you just essentially have fewer cars because people take the ferry, people walk, people ride their bikes, people take a bus. So when you have more of your population that doesn't drive, you're going to have fewer used cars, and it's pretty simple. Now, I'm not suggesting that people in Seattle go buy cars just so you'll have used cars, but when people are making those kind of lifestyle choices, that's what happens to the used car market.
I read that the cheapest used car market was Miami, Florida.
One of the reasons for that is that you have so many rental cars in Florida, and then those rental cars get sold by car dealers.
Oh, interesting. Well, that explains it.
It's a reason why rental cars are also cheaper in Florida, because there's more rental cars, there's more competition, and you can get a better deal.
So with the change in tax policy the first of the year, a lot of us are having a little bit less in our paychecks. Are we going to see that lack of spending power evidenced in either the used or new car markets?
That's a good question, and I think there's two things to say about that. First of all, you know, the payroll tax increase hasn't really affected people yet. It's one of those things that as the year goes on, I think people will notice that more, that lack of disposable income. But the other issue with that is that you have people who buy brand new cars who are kind of the highest demographic in the country. It's really an upper middle class to almost upper class market. You don't really have a lot of people who are scraping to put two pennies together buying new cars. People who have any kind of economic issues usually are in the used car market. And let's remember that there are actually 3 used cars sold in this country to every 1 new car that is sold. But you have to have new cars to feed the used car market.
As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking even if a dealer is trying to buy back my used car or get me to trade in, unless I can afford a new car, I'm going to have a hard time replacing my older used car with another used car because it's going to be expensive.
Right. So if you go to look at used cars versus new cars, it used to be that the discount was, you know, a brand new used car, 1-year-old used car, generally would cost 15% less than a brand new car, Well, that's shrinking. It's, last year it was down to 12%, and it's very possible that it'll be 10% this year. So depending on what kind of a deal you can get, if you can get a lease deal, a no-interest financing deal, or some kind of a payment deal, you might do better off buying a new car. It just depends car to car.
So as a consumer, what would you advise me to do if I were in the market for a car to replace my very old Subaru?
One of the things that you should do is be willing to be mobile. So you might look at the Seattle area, but you might think about looking in Oregon. You might think about going as far as someplace like Bend or someplace like Idaho. People do get on planes and go pick up cars. People do hire companies to pick up the car and send it back. I actually had reason to use one of those car shipping companies this summer, and it only costs about $375 to move a car, or maybe a little bit more if they're going cross-country. But you shouldn't rule out the idea that I found the car I want at the price I want, but it's in Denver. You might be able to still get a good deal if you buy the car from Denver, fly to Denver, drive it back, or hire someone to drive it back to Seattle for you.
That's Micheline Mickey Maynard. She covers business and the auto industry for Forbes.com and other publications. You can find her at MichelineMaynard.com. She's currently a visiting professor of business journalism at Central Michigan University in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. I spoke with her at her office yesterday. You're listening to Weekday on KUOW.
We're going to learn about some of the people behind old-school radio sound effects in a minute, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Professor Giorgio Rizzoni was in his office at Ohio State University when a group of students came to him with an idea. They wanted to build an electric car, one that ran so fast it would break world records.
At first, I thought it was insane, but it turned out that it could be done.
Coming up on the story, the electric bullet that doubles as a car.
That's this afternoon at 2 on KUOW's second program service. It's at KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Rotary Club of Des Moines, presenting the 9th annual Poverty Bay Wine Festival, March 1st through the 3rd at the Landmark on the Sound Event Center in Des Moines. Live music, local food vendors, and wine from over 25 Washington State wineries. More information at dmrotary.org.
45 degrees and rainy across Seattle. 10:36. Can't figure out what you want for lunch today? Hang on, we'll get a recommendation from food writer Sarah Dickerman in 15 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman, and we embark on our weekly journey back to the golden age of radio. It's a time when sound effects were in high demand. We didn't have our special theme song. Katie, do you want to hum it? Katie Sewell?
We could play it.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking. Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
Oh, I feel so much more like I'm back in the golden age of radio, Katie Sewell.
You need that moment to transition.
Yes, you've taken me back in time. Katie Sewell is with us as she is every Thursday. And we have, we're not talking about the programs today, but this is an era where the sound effects and the people who made them were kings and I guess queens.
Some women, yes. They were in high demand. That doesn't mean that they were all equal, though, Marcy.
Okay.
There was a pecking order. And that order was based on people's skills and their experience, sure. But even more than that, the pecking order reflected what they were really good at.
Okay.
And I thought it would be fun to go through it. Let's start at the bottom.
At the bottom of the pecking order. Shall okay, we? You got it.
At the very bottom of the pyramid are the technicians. And they're responsible for maintaining the sound effects. But their most important job was designing and building them. In fact, without the technicians, many of the sound effects that we have wouldn't have existed in any kind of believable way. Let's take a rainy street scene, for example. So now we're out. Now we're out on the street in the rain.
I like that. That sounds pretty realistic to me.
Yeah. Well, for just a little bit of rain, the sound effects department used to put BBs in a can and rattle them around, or they would crinkle tissue paper.
Uh-huh.
But if the rain had to go on and on, that was the problem that needed solving. And the technician named Stuart McQuaid was the one that solved that problem by inventing the rain machine.
Ah.
Which was a suspended box that steadily drops sand onto a piece of sheet metal below.
Huh.
And you know, while we're at it, we might as well add a little thunder to that rain. Because Stuart also invented the thunder screen.
Wow.
And technically, we should add wagon wheels to that too, because he also invented the speed-controlled wagon wheel.
That's amazing. And this is a man who's at the bottom of the heap?
Exactly.
I'm elevating him, I think, posthumously. I don't think he's still around, is he?
I have no idea. Probably not.
Well, if he's listening, you are now at the top.
All right, so let's move up to the next notch, shall we? The next notch up were called the button pushers. These were people who were assigned to shows that didn't have very many sound effects, things like soap operas. And they were called button pushers because many of their sound effects literally had a button attached. Like a doorbell.
Ding dong.
Or maybe a door chime buzzer.
Is that a door?
That's what people's doors used to sound like.
Wow.
Are you glad it doesn't sound like that anymore?
Yeah, no kidding.
How about an oven timer?
Nope.
No. Oh, no, no.
That doesn't sound like an oven timer to me.
Radio 6. There you go.
Ding.
And a tea kettle.
So was this actually a real tea kettle that they recorded?
Well, often it was either a record or they had a tea kettle going.
Okay.
Yeah. We could have lemonade.
Lemonade. Ah.
Yeah, you get the idea.
I do.
Those are the kind of sounds that the button pushers are responsible for. And most of these button pushers didn't really like being button pushers.
I can imagine. It doesn't sound like the most intellectually stimulating job.
Yes, boring.
Uh-huh.
But the upside of the job was it was a lot easier. And their hours were better because they're working daytimes instead of nighttimes. And they get paid the same as everybody else. So
okay,
everything has an upside, Marcy.
But you're bored out of your mind.
Yes. Well, let's move up.
Okay.
The next level in the sound effects pecking order is where most of the sound men are situated, and they're called the artists.
Uh-huh.
These are the people that can be put on any kind of show, and they do a great job, and they were very steady, and they were in demand. For complicated scenes, there might be four of them working together, but the radio studios didn't want to hire more than one sound person if they didn't have to. So whether or not a sound man could actually handle the job alone had a lot to do with the amount of sounds that were required and how complex they were. But it also mattered where the sounds were located in the script.
Okay.
For example, it's pretty easy to type on a typewriter.
Okay.
And it's easy to knock on a door. But doing them at the same time is really, really hard.
Okay, unless you have three hands.
Former radio sound effects man Richard Mott, who gave me that example, suggests that if you don't believe how hard that is, you should try it. So get it ready, everyone. Now, pretend you're typing with one hand and knock
click, click,
on a door with the other.
Click, click, click. No, I can't. I want to type with both hands. I'm not able. It's like rubbing your stomach and patting your head.
Yep.
Wow. So
that would require two sound men.
I see.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, let's move up to the last category.
Okay.
Shall we?
Yes, we can.
The very top of the sound effects heap. And these are the people that are called the stars.
They really were called the stars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Their skills weren't any different from the artists, but they were different. Their personalities were different.
Ah.
These were showmen.
Okay.
They loved performing sound effects in a very dramatic and very uninhibited way. And so, for instance, they would take a cue that says, door opens, avalanche of junk falls.
Okay.
And something that could sound like this. And they would not only make it sound terrific, they would make it visually funny for the studio audience too. So they would have a guitar that falls into a bunch of bowling pins that smash into a clock, which upsets a sword.
Like Rube Goldberg, huh?
Which sets the roller skates rolling,
that kind of thing.
Whatever they wanted to do. And that led to bigger laughs.
Where'd you say, Molly? On the shelf in this closet?
Yes, but be careful, dearie, because that shelf is loose and it's...
Yeah, running. I know. I'll get out of my way, Gildersleeve, while I get that...
Oh,
know you did, but I had to get that screwdriver.
What did you want the screwdriver for?
I wanted it to fix that shelf.
That's from the comedy show Fibber, McGee, and Molly.
Well, I just have to say, I'm imagining in my mind them actually moving and falling and things crashing all over. That isn't really what it looked like, was it?
Yeah.
Really, things were just flying all
over? Well, they used to set it up on a staircase. And so they would knock over the stuff at the top and it would start to tumble down the staircase, into more and more things.
I've seen video, for example, of Garrison Keillor, and maybe you're going to talk about that in a while, but the sound effects people are right out there in front of the audience. Is that where these artists were as well?
Yes.
These stars?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
The thing, interestingly enough, Bob Hope had a sound effects man that worked with him that was one of these stars who was competing with him for laughs.
Uh-oh.
Because he was so fun to watch. And Bob Hope didn't really like that, how much attention he was getting. And so he requested that he be moved behind a curtain. The sound effects man, of course, was having none of that. You know, you either let me be out front or I'm not working on
I'm taking
show
my great
anymore.
Talents to yeah. some other. And
Bob Hope recognized that he needed that man, and
wow.
he kept him.
So comedies like Fibber McGee and Bob Hope, that's where these stars were?
Right, because that way that they could get applause and laughs, too, for what they were doing. And in turn, they benefited the comedy shows because people were laughing harder.
Sure,
and they
obviously.
Needed the laughs. Now, these stars, because they were in demand, they often demanded more money. They would demand overtime for setting up special sounds. They would demand overtime for packing those sounds up.
Wow.
Overtime for shopping for things that made sounds.
Fun. It was the job to have, huh?
It was the job to have. And were they worth it? Well, the shows thought so. The stars really did give us some of the most memorable radio sounds that we have, like Fibber McGee's closet that you just heard there, or the sound of Jack Benny's car. Even Jack Benny and Mary Livingston can't help but laugh when it comes to
Let's
the car.
Let's get going. Start the car, Rochester.
Yes, sir.
Try it again, Rochester.
Yes, sir.
It started. It started.
Off we go into the wild blue yonder by tonight.
So I could tell there was some mechanical, but there's some actual sound effects, human...
Verbal
sound effects, that putting sound, right, is a mouth.
Yeah. And he does a great job of blending the two of them together. So when you ask the question, were they worth it? Yeah, they were. And in the fact that they not only cracked up the comedians themselves, but they kept the audience sort of rolling along.
I know we're in the golden age of radio, and that's fabulous, but I'm jumping ahead to 2012, 2013. A couple years ago, you spent several weeks with the Prairie Home Companion working behind the scenes, and... I wanted to talk about how the live sound effects guy on Prairie Home compares to what folks like this were doing, because it's somewhat the same, isn't it?
Somewhat. He's more streamlined than what they were doing. Fred Newman is their main sound effects
because Tom
man.
Keith passed away.
Tom Keith and Fred Newman were different types of sound effects men. Tom Keith, who passed away, as you mentioned, was much more traditional in the line with what people were doing during the Golden Age. He mostly liked to make sound using props. He didn't like using his voice as much. Now, Fred Newman's the opposite of that. He would rather do most of his sounds with his mouth and then add little tiny details with his hands.
Huh.
And it actually, because he's so good with his mouth, it gives him a very wide range of things. And, you know, and then you see him knocking on doors and, you know, rattling dog collars and things like that. But he's doing a lot of it with his voice.
Now, that is an integral part. Like the Golden Age of radio, those sound effects on Prairie Home are really part of the show, right?
Really part of the show. It's interesting, actually, because Tom Keith, because he was a prop man, had the same thing that some of these men did, where you'd go on an epic search to try to find this something that made the perfect sound. And one of his things was he found the perfect pair of walking shoes that could make a sound if you put his hands in it of walking. And they finally sounded right. And he told me a story that at the end of a long season, maybe at the end of a show, Garrison picked up those shoes off the prop table and threw them into the audience. You know, just being like, thanks for coming.
He threw his shoes out?
And threw them into the audience. And of course, had to apologize to Tom Keith later when he realized how miffed he was that he had gotten rid of this perfect pair of shoes.
I'm sure that, that Garrison values his sound effects people as much as Jack Benny and the Fibber McGee and Molly folks, yeah?
Sure, yeah.
Equal stars.
He writes comedy for them specifically. That's why you hear so many dolphins.
Is that what we love about radio? Is that what I had no idea. Is that what we love about radio drama, that we know that all of that is created and it sounds so real, but yet it's not really the sound? I mean, one of the things that we love about radio
drama. One of the many things, yeah. I think it's more, what's interesting about sound effects is it's painting the scene, like the scenery. Like in a play, you would actually have a scenery. Well, that's not happening. It's all audio. So they're letting you, they're filling in the details, basically.
But, Katie, even in the movies, and we talk about radio, but even in the movies, the sound effects are added in, right?
Yes.
So it's not, I mean, the sound of me walking across the floor probably wouldn't have a sound if you saw me.
Mm-mm.
Not in the way that radio does.
Well, there's another joke, too, in radio where they used to say that people in America had the most uncarpeted floors in the world. Because, well, you know, it's always people's heels walking along. Oh. Which in reality, in your home, you know, you probably never hear your footsteps.
Yeah, I don't think I've paid attention, but now I might. Katie Sewell, as always, thank you for taking us back and actually peeking behind that curtain that they put over the sound effects, guys.
Yeah, you'll be interested to know that even though there were rankings like that, Marcy, the studio management had no idea those rankings existed. And so thankfully, they thought, of course, sound men could do anything. But thankfully, the producers and the directors saw the distinction.
Well, I appreciate it as always. It's a nice time to just settle back and think about magic that we do on radio. So mm-hmm. Thanks for coming in. And speaking of magic, we have to check in on the culinary side of it. It's Thursday, and food writer and home chef Sarah Dickerman is with us once again. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there.
Making magic involves many things, gustatory and auditory. And last I looked, I'm in a room that you can't see anything out of, but last I looked, it was kind of gray and a little bit dreary. And so where could I go eat today that would maybe pick up my spirits as well as satiate me?
Yes, if you want something that will sort of fill you up and remind you of a warmer climate, I thought we'd go to the Wandering Goose today.
Wandering Goose.
The Wandering Goose opened less than a year ago, and it's up on Capitol Hill on 15th Avenue, and it's a southern breakfast and lunch place run by Heather Earnhardt, who had been a partner in Volunteer Park Cafe.
Oh.
Already know that place.
Yes.
And so she's a wonderful baker herself and has great bakers working with her. So among other things, they make terrific morning pastries. But since we're talking about lunch, they also make great biscuits. And so I know a lot of people are nuts for biscuit sandwiches right now. I like my biscuit sandwiches quite simple. I like them with, you know, maybe egg, cheese, and maybe ham. I'm a classicist when it comes to biscuit sandwich. But they do more elaborate ones that involve fried chicken and pickles, or there's even a funny one that has peanut butter and banana on it with some bacon. So there's fun combinations.
That sounds good to me. Maybe I'm just hungry. Well, so you like simple biscuits. Is that your favorite?
My favorite is definitely just egg and ham.
I'm curious, before we talk a little bit more about the menu, what is it that all of a sudden Southern food is haute cuisine?
It is really interesting. I think it's an interesting combination of, there's just a lot of interesting young dynamic chefs who are cooking in the South right now. I think of Sean Brock from Husk in Charleston. I think of, you know, even someone like David Chang, who's like the hottest chef in New York, has been really pulling on Southern traditions of cured meats in his restaurants. So you'll see Benton's ham or bacon in his menu, and he'll slice it thin like prosciutto, like you would, you know, like the American country hams. They're treating sort of almost like a prosciutto.
Hmm.
So there's a real amount of energy there. And then, you know, there's the funny thing that is a trend, and, you know, people are nuts for biscuits right now. Here on the West Coast, I think one of the big sparks for biscuit craze was the in Portland. There was a biscuit food cart called, I think, Pine State. I might have the name slightly wrong, Pine State Biscuits, and just got really popular. So some of that just travels like wildfire.
Well, the Wandering Goose also does a brioche bread.
They do sandwiches on like a brioche bread, and my favorite sandwich at the Wandering Goose, I think, is the oyster bolt, which is actually fried oysters with bacon and a little pepper jelly, you know, that sweet pepper jelly.
Yeah, that sounds delicious.
Oh, it is good. And then they do great sides, too. So sometimes if you don't feel like you should be eating, say, a biscuit sandwich, or you just want a different change of pace, they do wonderful braised greens, really good grits, and peas, you know, which are kind of Sea Island peas, which are kind of bean.
So is this only a breakfast lunch place?
They have Friday dinners that are special Friday dinners, but for now it's just breakfast and lunch. And it's really nice if you can get in. It's hard, I know, for people who don't work on Capitol Hill. It's nice if you can get in midweek because, of course, come brunch time, people start thinking this is just the right place to go.
Yeah, so after I eat my biscuits with ham and eggs and cheese and or my oyster bowl, which sounds fantastic, is there a little sweet course that I could have there?
Oh, for sure. There's one of my favorite desserts they have is just a very simple cookie made with Steen's cane syrup, which is, you know, in the family of molasses, but much lighter handed, not as tarry. And it's just a chewy, lightly spiced cookie. I think it's just almost a perfect cookie for me, but almost unadorned. And I kind of like that about it. And then they have, you know, these giant layer cakes.
Because that sounds pretty Southern to me. Yes. Well, that is Wandering Goose on Capitol Hill. We have a link at our website. But I'm going to just pull you back because I've been doing a lot of cooking at home. It's still post-holiday for me. And you've got a recommendation for Nigel Slater's Ripe Cook Orchard?
Ripe, A Cook in the Orchard.
Cook in the Orchard. So I know about Tender, which was about vegetables. Is this about fruit?
It is. It's the companion volume to Tender. And it's beautiful. Like Tender, it has these very sort of almost slightly mournful-looking photographs of his of the food and the garden. There's some beautiful photographs of the garden in winter with, you know, a pear covered in snow. So it's a very satisfying book to look at. And it covers these... Nigel Slater is a British writer, wonderful writer, and also has a knack for what you can do at home that's wonderful. And it's not about trying to do too much and garnish a million different ways. You know, he has recipes for very simple apple cakes, for apple crumbles, for, you know, quick sautés of plums or a quick plum chutney, you know, all sorts of things that are really inspire you to cook at home and try things. And he loves the variety of fruits you might get in a garden or through your favorite farmer's market. So he talks a little bit about how to plant things, what are great varieties for eating, and you know, if you make an apple crumble with one kind of apple, you'll get one thing that might be kind of soupy almost, but kind of delicious, and then another one might be rather firmer. And he doesn't really judge which one is the better final crumble, but well, he kind of enjoys the spectrum.
They're all delicious. It sounds like good winter dreaming, or at least late winter dreaming. Food writer Sarah Dickerman has a cookbook and lunch spot recommendation for us every Thursday. The cookbook is A Ripe Cook in the Orchard by Nigel Slater. The restaurant Wandering Goose, you can find out more about Sarah and read her writing at sarahdickerman.com. She's also at Slate, The New York Times, sometimes Bon Appetit. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us today. You can hear archived editions of our show at our website, kuow.org. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, and Andy Hurst. Danielle Anthony Goodwin is our intern. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. Tomorrow, Friday, your take on the news. We're also going to hear from Mark Maron and talk about teens and violence. It's just some of what's in store for us tomorrow on Weekday on 94.9 KUOW. Thanks for listening. I'm Marcy Silman.
The Seattle Sonics left town in 2008, but did you know the team's official collection of memorabilia is still here?
And so we are the stewards for these wonderful treasures. We wanted to make sure that they stayed in town, and so did everybody involved with it.
We're gonna take a peek at the trophies, banners, jerseys, and bobblehead dolls that make up the Sonics collection this afternoon at 2. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW-Bothell Global Executive Mini MBA program. Faculty-led tours of India, Japan, China, and Thailand are designed to foster understanding of global business markets and help develop trade contacts, starting this October. More at uwb.edu/business/mini-MBA.
I'm Norman Olney.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.